Chapter 10. Why End the Fed? The Federal Reserve should be abolished because it is immoral, unconstitutional, impractical, promotes bad economics, and undermines liberty. Its destructive nature makes it a tool of tyrannical government. Nothing good can come from the Federal Reserve. It is the biggest taxer of them all. Diluting the value of the dollar by increasing its supply is a vicious, sinister tax on the poor and middle class. The Federal Reserve's monetary policy has brought us to where we are today, in a tragic economic mess. Though the dollar survives for now, the international financial system built over the past 38 years has been brought down by market forces. The fiat dollar reserve standard that evolved out of the breakdown of Bretton Woods in 1971 has come to an end. That is the significance of the economic crisis in which we find ourselves. Continuation of the same inflationary policies that led to this disaster cannot revive the current system or bring back the Bretton Woods system of 1944. They are finished. What it can do is destroy the dollar. Unfortunately, since the housing bubble burst, signaling the end of the monetary era, everything Congress and the Fed have done has set the stage for a dollar crisis. That's very bad news, since the rejection of the dollar will create, mainly out of fear and lack of any other ideas, an even greater crisis than the collapse of the international financial system. The evidence is abundant that the Fed is at fault and should be abolished. So far, though, all Congress has done is give it even more power as the principal central economic planner. Karl Marx's fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto is clear. Centralization of credit in the banks of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. This does not mean that everyone who advocates a powerful central bank is a communist. It does mean that if one is inclined toward authoritarian rule, a central bank is of the utmost benefit. A central bank, by its very nature, is the opposite of a commodity standard of money. A gold standard does not require an authority to run it. If a central bank comes into being when a gold standard is in place, the purpose is to circumvent or eliminate the restrictions the gold standard places on those who want to enlarge the government over the opposition of the people. The only government involvement needed for a gold standard to work is to enforce anti-fraud laws and contracts. Inflation and debasement of currencies have been around for a long time. Before modern-day central banks, the government, a king or a tyrant with monopolistic powers over the monetary system, could choose to debase the currency for some ulterior motive, many times to pay for war and expand an empire. The irony is that once the power over money is used to build the state, in time the very process of monetary debasement frequently destroys the empire with an economic crisis of its own making. From the time of Constantine I, for six centuries, the Byzantine Empire thrived in international trade and commerce with a gold standard. Not only did Byzantium believe in honest money, it endorsed free trade and rejected the principles of mercantilism. The gold coin, the byzant, was used all over the Mediterranean and known throughout the world. For 600 years, the byzant maintained its value, keeping price inflation in check while the economy thrived. In 1071, Nicephorus III Bithynitis reduced the amount of gold in what was then the world's most used coin. Fighting a war with the Turks was the excuse for the devaluation. Byzantium lost the battle against the Turks and lost its currency. Financial chaos erupted and brought an end to the Byzantine Empire. Historians claim the end of Byzantium resulted from a financial tragedy. Although the worldwide elites of our day are very powerful and rich and control central banks, they too will face limitations, just as Byzantium did nearly 1,000 years ago. The banking elite may be laying plans for even more control through globalization of trade and financial controls in a worldwide central bank managing a new fiat currency, but the laws of economics will prove cumbersome for them to overcome. The durability of gold as money was verified once again in December 2008. Archaeologists discovered nearly 300 gold coins dating back to AD 600. The coins were issued by the Byzantine emperor. The coins were every bit as valuable as they were 1,400 years ago and more. One must wonder what our Federal Reserve notes will be worth when discovered in some hideaway 100, 50, or even a year from now. There's no way society can build a lasting and prosperous economic system without money of real value that lasts. To understand exactly why the Fed must go, one must realize that a commodity used as money is needed for a society to be free. It is as much an argument for gold as it is against a central bank. We need not dictate the exact commodity to be used as money in a free society, but history up until now has overwhelmingly chosen gold and silver as money. Gold was naturally selected by people to use in exchange and trade for more than 6,000 years. In 4000 BC, Egyptians had bars of gold stamped with Pharaoh's name and used them as money. The first real coinage was introduced by the Lydians in approximately 750 BC. Certain characteristics made gold a natural choice as money. It didn't become money merely because some government decided to use it as such. A recognizable substance that was easily portable and that had inherent value was called for. Some say money should serve as a store of value, easily divided, scarce, and desirable. Its most important function is to act as a means of exchange to facilitate trade. Most people recognize that prices of all goods fluctuate and the free market adjusts these changes quite efficiently. Some mistakenly think the value of gold is rigid and leads to stable prices of goods and services. Since gold supplies are limited compared to government's ability to print paper money, it indeed does give us much more stable prices. But the value of gold or silver or Federal Reserve notes is affected by their supply and relationship to other commodities. That is why the system of bimetallism, that is, fixing the ratio of gold to silver, was not a satisfactory system in our early history. Money developed in early history to facilitate trade and avoid the cumbersome transactions required by barter. Today's complex world trade could not exist without money. Bartering works only in primitive economies. Sometimes, though, modern economics become primitive and barter returns, such as occurs after wars and then financial crisis. If we're not careful, it could happen again to us. The importance of money is obvious, and though gold may not be rigid in value, it becomes practical because of its scarcity and efficiency in trade. The monetary unit of account is used as half of every economic transaction, the other half, of course, being goods and or services. One could argue that understanding the nature of money is crucial, since every transaction depends on the current perception of its value and the anticipated value of the money in the future. Dealing with economic problems is an overwhelming task for a society that is forced to use an indefinable paper currency that may quickly suffer loss of value at the whims of the monetary authorities who have monopoly powers over its supply. In a modern economy, no matter how sophisticated it may seem or how long in operation, the more an unpredictable fiat currency serves as the reserve currency rather than a non-government entity like gold, the more fragile will be the system. Because the authorities can get away with a fraud for decades, the imbalances will continue to grow and will eventually bring the system to a halt. The more definable the unit of account is, the more smoothly and longer the economy will operate. Paper money, politicians, and central banks always fail the test of time. When the Federal Reserve was established, its purpose, according to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, was to furnish an elastic currency to afford means of rediscounting commercial paper, to establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States and for other purposes. This was pretty broad in scope. Look at what it has brought us after 95 years. No stability whatsoever, and numerous crises of historic proportions. An elastic currency. I've always been fascinated with this term. Think of it more as a method to allow the government and banking authorities to be elastic with their powers to inflate the currencies for whatever goal they seek. They paint it as the Federal Reserve serving as a lender of last resort in order to protect the workers and depositors. But that is not the prime purpose of having an elastic currency. In an interesting and good sort of way, gold is elastic. It might be said that it is flexible, efficient in dealing with all the factors that affect prices of goods and services and the value of money. It adapts to market forces. Its supply, unregulated, is always adequate. It serves to adjust for settling current account imbalances so much better and smoother than fiat currency does. Bernanke and Greenspan always conceded to me that the imbalances in the current account and the foreign deficits that we've run up are a serious problem, but would never concede that this reflected the shortcomings of the fiat dollar reserve standard. They would never concede that these problems would not have developed with the gold standard. But gold adapts monetarily and can be stretched to serve as money when prices drop as a consequence of high productivity. The purchasing power of gold goes up and is stretched to accommodate more transactions. There's too much concern about an inadequate amount of gold. This is a worry that need not be. Paper may be elastic in the sense of inflating and bailing out bad debts, but it also acts like a boomerang as the stretching money supply snaps back with both inflationary and deflationary consequences. Putting money in the right perspective is crucial. Money does not equal wealth. Gold alone is not wealth. Some believe that an increase in paper money will provide wealth, yet all it does is dilute the value of the existing money in circulation. Just automatically doubling the amount of gold in circulation may be a lot more fun compared to doubling the amount of paper currency, but it doesn't substitute for productivity and improve commerce and trade. If productivity doesn't go up, even doubling the gold supply will merely push prices up in the gold currency. Greenspan and I sparred over a definition of savings at one of our hearings. I considered it a bad sign that we were no longer saving and that all we were doing was borrowing and consuming, and that too often the borrowing was possible only because of an increase in home equity as a consequence of inflation. He argued that because the value of most people's homes was going up, this valuation represented savings. I strongly disagreed and claimed he was confusing debt with true savings. He thought it was perfectly fine for the increased value of people's homes to be borrowed against with the funds used for consumer purposes. If the value of one's home comes from savings and not from artificially inflated prices, there would be no housing bubble. If one puts down 20 to 30% on the purchase of a home, the value of the house may fluctuate with the economy for various reasons, but these changes couldn't create a housing bubble that is destined to explode. Wealth can't come from appreciating the value of a house in the boom phase of a business cycle. If one is a flipper and lucky enough to sell at the right time, he may become wealthier, but there is no increase in national wealth. But even this process does not create new wealth. It merely allows the seller to profit on a quick transaction. Some do manage to benefit from escalating prices, but when the boom ends, more suffer from the consequences of falling prices. Neither process can substitute for true savings. That requires living within one's own means and not consuming one's entire income. Our problems, of course, have been that we, as a nation, have consumed our earnings plus the borrowing required to satisfy our ravenous appetite for consumer goods.